Thank you for downloading this APGRD podcast.
This is a recording of Theatre Director Ian Rickson in conversation with the APGRD's Helen Eastman in November 2014.
We'd love to hear what you think, so tweet to us at APGRD
or visit us at www.apgrd.ox.ac.uk for news of our upcoming public events.
I'm going to start by asking, what drew you to Greek drama at that stage in your career, having mainly worked with New Writing and Naturalism up until that point?
Well, the raw material of the production of Electra is the actress who plays Electra, because she is on stage for almost every minute of the show. The actress who I've got playing Electra. Actually, it would be good to know how many of you have seen it. That's not a test. No, how many haven't? Because it's probably boring to go on about something you've never seen. But Kristin Scott Thomas plays Electra. And she, after us doing four or five things together, said, I have to play Electra. I just have to play it. And there was something about her compulsion that felt really viscerally, deeply focusing as a gauntlet to take up. And I'm embarrassed to say, in this setting, I had been intimidated by the Greeks. I had been thrown by the focus on the gods and by fate. And I had also been intimidated by some of the archaic, poetic, and dusty translations of the plays I'd read. I'd always known I wanted to do Philoctetes because I felt there was something very moving and beautiful and strange about that play that was nonetheless direct. So I reread Electra, and I had had a premise that the best songs, the best novels, the best plays tend to be about one thing, and that is the processing of loss. And Sophocles' ability to write about loss, grief, about obsessive, repetitive, pathologically ingrained grief, about fresh grief, about all the colours of revenge and fury and anger and blame and victimhood that are part of grieving, felt to me so profound and modern and challengingly nourishing that I said yes. And then you start working out how you might do it.
And when you first read it, did you read the Frank McGinnis translation first? Was that the first one you read?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
And in terms of, I know when choosing a translation you looked at lots, but what drew you to Frank McGinnis's?
I think you look at somebody like Anne Carson, who's a poet I'm sure we all love, and it's so beautifully rendered in her ability to poetically get at the original, but perhaps not so theatrical. And I love Kenneth MacLeish, and I even love some of those dusty old penguins because there's something very true about them. But Frank, as a channeler of Sophocles, felt to me like he had the right sort of savage folk poetry that absolutely jump leads you into a kind of bloody, soulful, dynamic, and I have to say, accessible reading of the play. I think he had a premise. He did a lecture at the University of London, where Edith works, saying that if he, after long reflection, couldn't understand a reference, he would cut it, which isn't as Sophocles for beginners as it sounds. I think he's rendered a very dynamic, sprung take on the play that 11-year-olds can understand, but doesn't feel like it shortchanges 81-year-old academics.
And when you'd chosen that translation, I remember we met right at the start of a process of research. Ian is incredibly thorough with his and meticulous with his research in preparation for a production. In many ways, both you were travelling, you were reading, you were watching. Can you tell us a bit about that process of discovery,
Sure. Working
your way into the play?
And I should just say there's no virtue in the amount of preparation you do. I only do it because I'm so nervous and intimidated about directing the play. So if I do a lot of research and prepare myself, then hopefully I can get myself to a place you want to be in rehearsal, which is thoroughly open. The more prepared you are, the more you can absolutely enter the present and make and play live. Well, the first thing for me was I found these three gods who were empowering and encouraging and thoughtful and suggestive, which was Oliver Taplin, and Edith, and yourself. And basically, I selfishly just asked them questions. I hung out in the archive here. I wrote down lists and lists of questions. What do people do with a chorus? Explain to me Stichomythia. What do we know about Sophocles, etc.? And those three people, and particularly Edith and Helen, who came into rehearsals, were so fortifying in terms of helping me on a path. I did three separate workshops, one a whole week with young directors and two on the chorus, just to try out ideas. Can you do the play without Pylades, who is a silent companion of Orestes? What are the options you've got for the chorus? You know, we know that there were 15 people at one stage, and 13. I'm remembering my research, probably what you told me. I was doing the play in the round, which is another part of the research. How do you find a space for the play? Do you want to do the play end on? What does that do to the audience? How do you make the audience complicit and involved so they're absolutely implicated, like a chorus, rather than perhaps watching something framed in a distant place? And if you've got a play in the round, you have to be careful about how many people block conduits the audience have onto the stage. So I felt something, which I tried in the workshops, good about three women in the chorus, three generations, and the thought about the play, and with three women in the chorus, and you've got three women in the play, of course, the mother, the two sisters, and then you've got these three men, and there's something about the magic number of three and these three threes that felt really right. And I tried various ideas out, but sometimes I think perhaps I should have been bolder and kept them. So I tried one idea out, which anybody who's a director, I recommend you try, because I think it could be really good, which is that all the chorus learn all the lines, and every night, whoever says what line says it. So you know there's going to be Children of Atreus, Your Suffering Has Ended, etc. You might say all four lines there, or there might be three on a... And that felt quite exciting, but in the end, I have to admit, I became a controlling director and thought, I'm going to divvy out the lines. I have a little scheme to try not to be equal and democratic and regular, but to try and create three different women and a young one who's really quiet, who gets sort of recruited by the defiant rebellion that is in the play and then ends up speaking a lot. And she's the one in the end who's sort of saying, do it. And I just want to say that to you, that I think a really thrilling thing about Electra is it's a very optimistic play about rebellion. The young do win. They overthrow the powers that be. I think this play is a dangerous play, because if it works, you as a member of the audience become complicit, because you empathise with, probably, hopefully, Electra and Orestes, and then you're complicit in a double murder. So you leave the theatre thinking, hang on a minute, I don't advocate violence. But if the play's worked, you're going, yes, come on, do it. So this play is dangerous. But I'm rambling now. To answer your question, I did a lot of research. I went to the place where the play's set. I went to the place where Sophocles was when he wrote it, under the premise that if you can get inside what's happening to the writer, socially, politically, and if you can get inside where they are, it might help you burrow deeper into the play. I read lots of books. I really enjoyed the whole massive industry that there is around these plays, which is actually terrific. Archives like this are so useful.
And you were just saying about the travelling. It felt, in terms of the design of the show, it felt very much that had been informed by the travelling you were doing in Greece over the summer. Can you tell us a bit about the design collaboration?
Sure. Where do you set these plays? Do you do really purposeful allegorical settings, like let's set it in Derry in the 1980s, or the Balkans, or somewhere, I don't know, I could give you a list. Or do you try and set them in the period? But you run the risk of it being a sort of masterpiece theatre, slightly museum production, which could be brilliant. And I was really thrown by two things. How do you do the chorus? Where are these plays set, and at what time? And I thought about, well, what experience are you having when you're reading the play? Are you reading it thinking, I'm in Albania in 1989, or in Germany in 1917, or something? I thought, no, you're having a sort of poetic, primal experience of the play. And if I could try and create a very elemental production with I mean, if you like, the five elements, which are earth, it's set on earth, water, there's a standpipe, fire, there's fire in the world of it, wood, there's a tree, and metal is the last element, there's the knife. If you do that, and you're clever enough with costumes and props so you are, your word, panchronic, then you're releasing the audience from having to take on board your scaffold for the play. You're allowing them to have their own poetic private experience, which feels to me what Sophocles is doing. There's nothing authorial in the play. He doesn't end the play with these people will now be punished and the meaning is this. There's no triumphalism. He really does throw it out to you. So it felt to me such a modern play in the way it's designed to take place in the audience's head rather than on stage. So you want a world on stage that liberates that rather than contains it.
And just thinking about the ending, because there was quite a strong choice, I think, at the ending, that when Electra laid down with her mother's corpse at the end, the corpse was in the centre of the stage, if anyone did see it, and Electra made the choice to go and lie down with her mother, to try to hug her mother when she was dead. She hadn't made contact with her at all when she was alive, but once she was dead. Did that come out of rehearsals, or did you always envision that as where it would end?
That's a good question. I don't like to plan those moments. My job is just to create a room which is creative enough to allow the actors to play, so that's entirely that actress. She now, the Electra, has a photograph of her father, Agamemnon, which is hidden in a little sort of amateur shrine in this sort of Bacchettian ruined tree. And now she gets the photo of father. Does it sound good, this? I'll tell you anyway. Just started doing it last week. And she puts it inside the mother, the blanket the mother's in, and nestles in herself like a sort of Freudian idealized little triptych of mother, father, daughter, which is so poignant because she spent 87 minutes attacking her mother. And that's what's great about wonderful actors. They are suggestive, playful, open in the moment. And she'll do other things, by the way, other than nestle in with the mother. And I remember being told about, was it the Peter Stein one, where the Electra sort of attacks the mother and they had a sort of prosthetic Clytemnestra. But anyway.
And just talking about that element of play, can you tell us a bit about When you started the rehearsal process, I know that you did quite a lot of improvisation in the first week or two of rehearsals, just in terms of exploring family dynamics. I think it's quite illuminating to the production that that had happened. So how did you get started with the company?
It's a good question. Can you apply Stanislavski, loosely, to a play written, you know, 400 BC? I didn't know whether you could or not, but I do know that from Stanislavski we know if an actor thinks in pictures, if when an actor is talking about, let's say, Phocis, which is one of the locations in the play, if they have a vivid picture of Phocis or Phanateus, which to me are just blurry words, but if they think in pictures when they speak, I think the audience see. So improvisations might have mined those particular details. Or if you have a relationship with Nemesis, which personally I don't, because I don't really think about Nemesis, but Clytemnestra does, yeah. And all the chorus do. So all of those actors had to do specific work on their own relationship with every god, so that when these words are mentioned, they're not dead air, they're populated with a particular specific thing. So the chorus had to do work on who they had lost, in terms of members of their family, and who becomes present when. And that's what's great about rehearsal, that the actors can teach you, as a director, all the time about their characters and the play if you set up the right exercises. It's so much more boring being an expert and telling actors where to stand and what a bit should be like. It's much more rewarding and stimulating to make it together out of all that preparation.
And at what stage did you then bring them back to the text?
All the time. You're having the text there. You do a little thing and then you say, let's read that now. So the text is there and Lerb is there, you know, with the ancient Greek. We'd get him out and just try to look clever, really, but some people might be able to read a bit of it in ancient Greek, and that's really useful. I remember a lovely section of the play where Helen described in rehearsal how word order is very free in I'm teaching you to suck eggs, is very free in ancient Greek. And there's a beautiful moment where, I mean, one of the main characters in Electra is this working class, the servant, or the mentor, or whatever you want to call him. And he drives the whole thing, in a way, you could argue. And Sophocles, in his generosity, sort of looks after every character, gives him a moment with Electra, where Electra, and you talked about recognition, it feels to me recognition is a massive part of Electra, recognizes him and sort of reveres him. And the servant has a response, something like, I'm paraphrasing, there'll be time enough to talk some more, Electra. And the line in the ancient Greek, if you remember, is quite long and labyrinthine. But I think the way Frank places comma, Electra, the naming, and every there's a whole interesting thing in the, I'm rambling again, in the play about naming and the way you helped that actor find the importance of da-da-da-da-da-da-da, Electra. That it's not a falling away line, that is a downward cadence. There's something really sustained about the recognizing, speaking, and saying of this person's name who he hasn't seen for 20-odd years, Electra. And I think almost every character at one stage says her name at really interesting moments. And you cannot stop on this play. It's so full of, in its economy and its austerity, it's so full of amazing genius, really, in terms of its language, its form, how it feeds you.
Can I ask you about the music in it? Because I know there was an interesting thought process about what that music might be and how it might fit stylistically with the production, and also a discussion a bit with Frank about how it might, whether or not any music should preempt text at the opening or not. And obviously, you ended up working with PJ Harvey on it, and how did that come about? And we discussed singing at one point, moving away from it. So there was a journey with music.
Yeah. I think there are so many more radical and, if you like, truer to the ancient Greek versions of this play, which are more rhythmic, which are more theatrical, which have singing and dancing in them. As we know, that's what the chorus often did. They sung and danced. I tried for whole days at the Young Vic with young directors to get bits of the chorus sung. But every time I did it, it felt like I was exhibiting myself rather than allowing the language, and how amazingly charged the language is, to create its own spell on the audience. So instead I thought, well, and in fact one of these three, the trinity of experts, said to me, Sophocles wrote these plays knowing they'd be underscored. It's fine for you to have music underneath it. And I thought, well, if my production is timeless, it would be great to have some modern elements. And for me, one of the great modern rock star composers is Polly Harvey. So I just asked her to do the music. And she has a real humility. She just came to rehearsals, watched a lot, would go home. She had a big old hurdy-gurdy strange player, which she got making these drones. She slowed them down. She added electric guitar. And she'd just give me a CD every week. And I'd play bits of it while I was rehearsing. And again, I mean, what a lovely job to have the privilege to combine all these elements.
There are a lot more questions I'd love to ask, but I'm aware that there are probably lots that you'd like to ask as well. So at this stage in proceedings, is there anyone who would like to send us in a different direction or has a question for Ian? Or am I going to get to keep asking the things I'd like to ask? Oh, no, over here.
Can I ask about electric body language?
Yes.
When did that come? How did it come?
It's interesting, isn't it? I'm thinking of an analogy, because when you're cooking sometimes and you've got the finished meal, it's hard to say when did that meal in the pot turn into that. It's something to do with the way you stirred it, the temperature, how you added the elements, what order. But I'll tell you a few things. That actress is very psychologically motivated. To be candid, we both are in therapy, so we're talking about the meaning of things and the meaning of our lives and the losses we've suffered. That will be going into her thinking, how's that manifest in the body? One thing that Sophocles is brilliant about is the legacy of trauma, that everybody in the play is somewhat imprisoned in the age they were at when Clytemnestra's axe split Agamemnon's head open. Or you could say when Iphigenia was sacrificed, actually. But for Electra, certainly her witnessing of that violence. So that, I think, made Kristin think, OK, I'm 14, but I'm also an old crone. And I'm lucky enough to have a choreographer from Punch Drunk, Maxine, who just would sit in and would chip things in. And out of that mix, Kristin and I would do little exercises, where are you centered, how does your body carry pain, how do you mask pain? And then you've got to find a costume that somehow allows that duality of old woman, adolescent, pre-adolescent. And that's a great thing about that actress, that there's no makeup, she looks terrible, the dress is like a, you know, rags. You want to get your Electra feeling really marginalised, because it is a play about what it's like to be a woman in a very primal, patriarchal world, and how you overthrow those powers that be. You want to articulate that protagonist as marginal and close to beggar. Because she says she is. So I guess all of those things fed in, but it's really about that actress.
Sorry, question.
On the evening I saw it, Diana Quick was not there, and her role was played by an understudy. Given what you said about how very, very finely calibrated the performance is, How difficult is it to introduce an understudy after one person has been playing the role for so long?
I'm going to give a rambling answer to it. So, every night Mark Rylance played Jerusalem, which ends with this calling to the giants, to the gods of England, he would do a kind of cleansing ritual, and he would do a gratitude ritual in the shower, because he felt the play, in a really good way, was sort of shaking the cosmos. I went from doing a lecture, and so involved in that, an hour before the opening night, I got on a plane to do a play in New York, and I was in rehearsal at 9 a.m. the next morning. And on the first day it was playing to the public, I had a feeling of indestructibility. I just felt indestructible. I thought, I'll run on my usual running path by the Hudson River. This play I was doing in New York was called The River. My Elektra company were okay. And like Orestes in the story of the chariot, smack, I was knocked unconscious by a speeding pushbike and ended up, this is 3 weeks ago, in intensive care in New York with a fractured skull and all these things. And I thought about the play, and one of my actors said, yes, the gods were up to badness. I thought, thanks. And a night later, Diana Quick, doing a warm-up, they're very diligent, the actors in an ensemble, was playing in this warm-up, and she saw Orestes, her son, standing by this metal tap, which sits in a hollow of duckboards and whatever. And she said, don't stand there, Jack, because, you know, he's precious. And she stood there. Minutes later, she broke both of her wrists and was out for 10 shows. So I was thinking about the turbulence these plays create and how they come from this time of war and, you know, so much was at stake and fighting to keep democracy alive, and we're still going back to them. And what do we do in the action of performing them? And from my hospital bed to Diana's hospital bed, the actors, initially, to answer your question, it's quite thrilling because, you know, at 3 minutes past seven, this woman who's never done the play is told, and she thinks it's a joke, no, no, you are on. It's not a theatre joke. And it's sort of exhilarating for the actors because they come through it, etc., etc. And then it becomes complex because, like a member of your family leaving, being an absentee parent, it throws everything into a sort of abandonment dynamic. And our understudy was terrific, but actually, she's younger than Kristin. And because of that, she cannot come at, Clytemnestra cannot come at Electra with the same dominance that a brilliant younger actress can. So I'm in my hospital, this is so boring, I'm in my hospital bed in New York, and my Electra's saying, what are we going to do? And I'm then calling Diana Quick in her hospital bed, and Diana Quick then comes back with metal plates and casts, and does the play with such stillness that suddenly we're in the new place and the story goes on. But I so feel for my actors, particularly my Electra, because affecting the cosmos with all of these strange centrifugal forces 8 times a week, for the most part, is energizing and thrilling. But I think it takes its toll, and I'll love her forever for doing that 8 times a week. You know, other theatres, it's in repertoire, and you do it, you know, 4 times a week or something.
And it's yes, there's a question here. No, go please.
Well, I'm not sure how exactly to formulate the question on this, but for me, I think the most powerful one of the production we saw it when. The understudy was playing Clytemnestra, but for me the most powerful moment of all, I think, was when Electra has been told that Orestes is dead, and she collapses on the ground and calls his name twice.
Yeah.
Orestes, you were talking about naming.
Yeah.
And I work on World War I literature. What was going through my mind at that moment is Vera Brittain's description in Testament of Youth of when she got the telegram that her only brother was dead, And she went into the living room and saw a photograph of him and fell on her knees before it, calling, "Edward, Edward." Mm-hmm. He said, "As though all my crying and calling could bring him back."
Yeah.
And, of course, Electra's crying and calling does, in a way, bring him back. But I just wanted to ask you what the process was for arriving at that absolutely extraordinary enactment of the way one does call the name of the dead. How did you, the actress, together or separately, that incredibly powerful moment?
I mean, to disappoint you with some obvious things, you talk about it with as much perceptiveness as you just did. You might use an intertextuality. You might talk about a song or a poem, but you talk about it with as much reflection, honesty as you can. We had a psychoanalyst, Susie Orbach, come into rehearsal. That's helpful. You talk about the voice and you look at lamenting all over the world. I remember looking at a Haitian funeral and how certain women were keening and calling. And so everyone then sends that bit of YouTube round and dwells upon it. But there's nothing like practicing it in sequence with an audience. There's nothing like letting Sophocles guide the actress to how she feels when, as you say, she plaintively names the lost object of the brother. So you try lots of things out in rehearsal, and my job is to watch and listen and concentrate and feedback. But that it's that actress being deeply in the moment that releases it in a certain emotional pitch, and it would probably be different each night. Sometimes it is arid and bitterly plaintive. Sometimes it is like a wave. Sometimes it has a fury in it, because the whole play has fury, doesn't it? So you've got to be there, you know.
There was a question at the back.
I had a question about accent styles. There seemed to be something in it for everyone. I personally love Diana Quick. I think it's incredibly unusual to have someone deliver a classical role in quite an elevated, regal style. You don't see any work because it's seen as too obvious. I wonder, how did that come about? Because Aegisthus was very different again. Not at all a regal character.
Yes, I feel a bit like I did with your question, that partly I can't remember, other than thinking, like when you cook, it's all about the assembly and acquiring of ingredients. And I think the choosing of Diana Quick, who has a sexuality, a majesty, a sympathy, and an authority, that may end up in the sort of style or sort of sensibility that you're talking about, which the actor who plays Aegisthus has a different quality. So you're partly thinking, how can I tell the story with who's available? Just like you're thinking, can I get saffron in the market? Oh, I can't get saffron, but I can get turmeric, and that'll give me this thing. And then you're allowing each ingredient to be fully itself to tell the story. I think the other thing that I would have been thinking about with that character is, you could argue that Sophocles, given he's calling the play Electra, doesn't give us as much empathetic sympathy to Clytemnestra as Electra. But if I can balance that by casting it in a way where you feel for her, it will make your evening more challenging, because it won't be a play of goodies and baddies, which it isn't anyway, of course. But you can cast it that way, and actually it makes it a much more sort of closed evening.
I think I was there when you first suggested Aegisthus wasn't RP, and that was quite an extraordinary moment in terms of the way it changed his relationship with the language, because up until that point it was a very regal RP.
In the end, actually, he is speaking. Do you know, RP, received pronunciation. The guy who plays it, is his antecedents is the West Indies. So he did do it in a wonderful sort of Derek Walcott-like sonorous style. And he also did it in an African style. And then we talked about it, and we thought, well, no, RP in this play is the language of power. He would speak the language of power. So that's where he ended up, I think, accent-wise. Yeah.
The evening when I went to see it, I was quite surprised at the moment when the rest of the audience laughed, and I thought, how on earth did you laugh at this? I guess one moment was when the two men come out after the murder of Clytemnestra with their hands covered in blood, and I thought, what an incredibly sort of, you know, disturbing, sinister, really affecting scene, but I didn't find it funny at all, but I could sort of vaguely see that there was a sort of... could see it in a kind of dark and humorous sort of way. I was wondering sort of to what extent that was something we played for or anticipated.
I don't care for laughs at that moment, and we strive to kill any laughs at that moment. But you cannot control these plays. They are for the audience. The audience is spun like a top by Sophocles' brilliance. And you cannot be, as I am, snobbish and pretentious about laughs. Sometimes people laugh because they're at a pitch and they need to release. I'd say one in 20 shows, they laugh at that moment. And often it's young people who are... like, this play works so well for school kids. They're so kind of animated. But you have to let that be. But there are certain ways we have avoided laughs there, to do with the amount of blood on the hands, the regularity of the blood job, and the tempo of that moment. But I love the laughs elsewhere. And I have to say, I spent 5 weeks in a rehearsal where no one laughed. And suddenly you're in a theatre with 900 people, and this sort of bitter... fantastic defensive irony that Electra has. And Sophocles' wily, devious stagecraft provides such laughter. I mean, a strange laugh for me, which I had to look around and say, why are they laughing, is when it's sort of at the lowest moment when Electra's sort of finished, Sophocles sends on her sister, Chrysothemis, who says, everything's going to be okay. And the audience sometimes find this hilarious. And I think Sophocles would like that, that he's playing all the time with these clashing oppositions, and he's giving the audience a real workout, which, you know, not every play does.
Oliver, you had a question.
I want to ask about these sessions you did experimenting with singing. Do you think you might have found a way of using song? Was it something fundamental?
So this was my idea, that a bit like Bulgarian folk music, which comes from the gutter, and anybody can sing, from a crane driver to someone who's baking bread, I thought if you set up a lamentation language through song early on, then when the chorus, for example, they have a speech, I'm sure you know, consider the birds of the air, it's quite near the end of the play, it might rest the audience's ear to suddenly introduce something tonally beautiful. So I thought, you have to set up a language of singing early on. So what if you hear a lamentational language early on, before even Electra comes on? And my writer, Frank McGuinness, said, you can't. The first thing you've got to hear after the prologue of Orestes and the Servant has to be Electra's. It's musical in its own way. Her howl. So I thought, okay, well then, can I get the chorus singing after that? Well, no, because everything is so sinewy in the way Sophocles has created this body of this play. So I couldn't find my first bit of melody. And I think, like I said before, when I had got bits of it sung in these workshops, it felt like me showing off, me saying to the audience, oh, look, and now I can do this thing where they sing a bit. And it felt to me a little bit more held and charged that everything musically is to do with the music of the language, which is, I think, in Frank's version, it has a sort of balladesque quality, which is rhythmic and music in its own way. But as I've said to you at the beginning, I sometimes regret, didn't do that. I sometimes regret, why didn't I push the idea of Electra being in chains, you know, for the whole show? She's in this big metal chain. You know, why didn't I go a bit more brave with this genuinely choral thing with the chorus's lines. But maybe that's for next time. What do you think, Fiona? I was going to ask you, why is recognition so important in the 19th century? Well, I'd say now, and for Sophocles, because we're upstairs with Helen's baby, who's how many months?
9 weeks.
And it struck me that all the adults in the room, the baby's being looked after as we speak. I should just say that.
We put it in a filing cabinet. Just like
you know, we know from, I don't know, Melanie Klein or Jung or whatever, that we all long. I'm answering the question. You'll be better at it. We all long for a kind of reparative recognition, whether that's, I know exactly what you mean, or I see you, I feel you, I hear you. But what was happening upstairs in this room was all the adults wanted the baby to recognize them. And when the adults were reflected in this little, did you say 4 months?
9 weeks.
9 weeks! In this little 9-week-year-old creature's eyes, the adults felt so good. And in this world of sort of strange, amazing turnabouts, that recognition scene, yeah, I mean, what do you make of it?
I think the problem with the recognition scene is really a problem for classes, that particular recognition scene, because you see it as being very formulaic, because it's always compared with the Aeschylean one and the Euripidean one, and therefore I've always found it quite difficult to understand why people come at it or see it afresh as they did at the beginning of the 18th century. And for me, what you did was enable me to forget that kind of comparative perspective, that as classicists, I think we always see it, realise that it is precisely the kind of purity that comes out of the recognition moment that you're saying that we all had with Helen's face, that was there in for from Kirsten Scott Thomas, and it really was so moving, so beautiful, and so that's why I said thank you. And I mean, we're an audience really of plasticists here, but one or two exceptions maybe. But I think it is quite hard for us to see what Aristotle clearly saw and didn't see as being formulaic or hackneyed, because that was a given for the recognition. Yeah.
Interesting.
So we're all too naturalistic, I think, you know.
Right.
You know, you come at it
yes.
in a different way.
Right.
Yeah.
Chip in, Edith.
Yeah, I mean, just on the recognition, there's three things. One is it's incredibly extended because of the false news. Yeah, we're aware that he's around and has not been recognised. You know, they haven't had the joyful mutual recognition for, I think, probably longer than almost any Greek tragedy. The other one that's comparable is everybody who knows me knows which play I'm going to see, and Taurus of Euripides, where it's a good 400 lines of playing around with you. Now, if we had our other colleague here, alas he cannot be, Felix Budelmann, he will actually tell you that if you put electrodes on the brain and examine the brain chemicals at the moment of recognition, the flood of endomorphins.
That's brilliant.
No, it's absolutely there. I wish you were here. To talk about that, but what I've got very interested in it is that the 4th century vases on which we've got, and Oliver's the expert here, not me at all, but the ones that we know were most popular in terms of the number that have come up in the tombs from Italy, if you're burying your dead with theatrical scenes, it's always this brother-sister recognition. I mean,
there's
more pots of Electra and Orestes and Pignara and Orestes. Isn't that right, Oliver?
Very, very obvious.
Yeah. Now that is because it's something to do with when you're mourning your dad in the funeral, you're reconstituting your family as the younger generation with that optimistic thing about going on. Actually, what you want, that recognition scene, set off the right brain chemicals appropriate to getting through the funeral. I mean, it's incredibly interesting. There's a whole nexus of things. I was actually thinking very much about those vases while I was watching KST, as she referred to herself. But it's very, very interesting. Can I ask one question while I'm on?
Of course,
Because you alluded briefly to problems with the God effect at the beginning. minute.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is quite a big problem to have with Greek tragedy.
Yeah.
is the metaphysical one.
Yeah.
And that is really, really tough.
Yeah.
And I know we wrestled a bit in over the text, over the, you know, the word for a fury, Eris,
yes.
And Electra,
yes,
calling herself that. Do you feel in the end that you had got rid of the metaphysics and you got it down to ethics? Is that what you want?
Well, I mean, it seems to me a very existential play, Electra, in this iteration of Sophocles through Frank McGinnis. It feels like the key word in the play is nothing. That, are the gods here? Are they real? It feels like everything that happens in the play is because of people. And the very brutality of the way it ends, with no agency, it seems, of fate or the gods, it feels to me so modern. So yes, I hope so, because I think the play then becomes this fantastic gauntlet to the audience to find their own way of breaking cycles, of living their own life, of taking responsibility. It feels to me thrilling in that way.
But the one thing that I think, I mean, did really come over really well in the end, and the one thing I really remember from rehearsal, though, was the prophetic power of dreams that the chorus couldn't get until I told them the Greeks all,
yeah,
dreams told the truth about the future. Just what that dream of Clytemnestra.
Yeah.
I'm not quite, I mean, you worked, whatever you did, it worked, but that meant a certain religious view on what a dream was in terms of message from the gods or something.
Yeah, but the dream could be good for Clytemnestra. That dream is quite, has a lot of latitude in it, which could mean the play has any conclusion. I think you can look back retrospectively and say, oh yeah, the dream, whatever. But this, I mean, go on, carry on.
No, it's just that that was a piece of information.
Yes.
Religion.
Absolutely.
Which did seem to galvanize, yeah, especially the chorus.
Absolutely. No, it's, and that's why it's great having experts into rehearsal. Actors, they're just food for actors, because you can say something that you know because you know the Aeschylus and you know the Euripides so well, and actually actors are like detectives hunting for clues. They grab that and then they can use it, and then they'll say, oh yeah, no, it's like that thing Edith said, da-da-da-da-da-da. And that can stimulate you for an hour just working on one element. It's great.
It's very interesting what you're saying about the play being human-driven and therefore able to psychologise it, keep it ethical, and there isn't this overarching moment of fate at the end. And I know you're very interested in Philoctetes as a play. So leading a bit to the,
yes,
question of, now you've done it, are we going to get more Greeks from Ian Rickson?
I know.
I know you're really interested in, but that's a problem, because
exactly,
they go through the cycles of revenge and human behaviour, and then a god comes out at the end.
I know. You need a good, you need a good idea, don't you, for how you do that last section of the play.
So you're 95% of the way through the play, isn't
it? Yeah.
Yeah, and what, Seamus Heaney cut it, didn't he? Or
he has the chorus.
Do it.
He does a thing. The chorus become the god at the end, so that he weirdly, metaphorically, makes the
interesting
collective represent the,
yeah,
the god.
Yeah.
So the power of people
are, yeah,
become the power of fate. But it is. Do you think you'll go on to tackle more?
It's an impediment that,
yeah,
that quality in the plays.
You have sort of done the one play that doesn't have that impediment in some way.
Electra, exactly.
Electra doesn't. You don't have,
exactly,
to do gods. You don't have to. You know.
Yeah.
You can cycle.
The chorus are more integrated. Yeah. It's more dialogue heavy, less speechified.
And I think there's an interesting question looking forward as well about, having tackled a classical play, do you think it will change the,
yes,
any, the way you direct,
yes,
contemporary,
already has,
naturalistic work?
And if anybody directs plays, I'd recommend you do your Beckett, your Shakespeare, and your classical, because they arm you. They are so, they're such great workouts. And what Sophocles teaches you for directing is amazing, to do with a clarity and an economy and a fantastic dynamic colour. It's brilliant. And his interest even in something like cunning. You know, very early on in the play we get this concept of cunning that, by the way, they did an improvisation of this. So the kid who plays Orestes came out of the tomb at the cave at Delphi, and the servant was waiting for him. And the servant is hoping perhaps that the Delphi has said 500 armies or weapons or some sort of incredible tank or something, and instead the Delphi said cunning, And the sermon's like, oh, it's just like the worst thing to get. But they did that improvisation. But then you think about cunning, and you think about how Sophocles loves cunning, that in the middle of the play, almost in the actual mathematical middle of it, there's this cunning moment where, correct me if I'm wrong, classicists, but when a messenger comes on in Greek plays, they generally tell the truth. So this messenger comes on and tells this incredible story, which is a lie. Well, we're listening to it, and it's such a good speech. It's sort of like Ben-Hur in its camera movement. We think, no, this has to be true. It is. No, oh, no, hang on. You wouldn't think that, classicist, but a lot of people would. And then, of course, the lovely paradox is it is true, because the servant loves Orestes. And it's quite possible in an hour that Orestes will be dead or will be lost to him, even if they win. So it's this fantastic encomium to Orestes, to the sort of son, who's absolutely truthful, yet the cunning of it is it's a lie. It's a Trojan horse of detail to trick the powerful, to trick Clytemnestra. Fantastic.
Are there any more questions from out here? Before I might jump in with
a
final one. Yes, of course.
You mentioned the Hilfstein. Where at the end, Electra pulled her mother's heart out. Behind that, and I think he was quite explicit about this, was von Hofmannsthal and Strauss.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether you had any kind of model anywhere, or any what I might call a driving influence, or whether you avoid that.
I think it's really useful to read about other productions. I remember you telling me about that. And the danger is, it's like putting yellow and black police tape around an idea. So when I saw Thomas Ostermeyer's Schaubühne Theatre in Germany's production of Hamlet, which I thought I should see, it cordoned off certain things that I might have done, because I thought, he did it so well, I can't do it. What I did was that old Brecht thing of you try and do an old play like a new play, a classic like a new play like a classic. So looking at what Sophocles gives you, Electra says, then and only then will I be rid of the wrongs he has done me. Which is sort of a three-line thing, and then she never speaks again. He sort of mutes her. Yet, the last 3 minutes of the production, of the play on the page, are Clytemnestra dead, Electra alive, with no words. So you just, in a way, relish what Sophocles has given you, that he's given you something wordless, full of opportunity, and you rehearse and rehearse and rehearse it, so you get your actress to a place where she can fully have gone through what she goes through in that amazing journey, and then you see what that creature wants to do with the body. And absolutely in rehearsal, she's done 28 things. But she seemed to gravitate to this silent, nestling, strange thing, which I just loved. But my job also is to be a stimulating, challenging force for that actress to keep her playing. So as I say, now she sort of nestles a photo of Dad in. And by the way, her photograph of Agamemnon, because they all had to research generals, and we had to try and make Agamemnon not a war criminal, because, you know, if you live in Mycenae and you've got Agamemnon, wow, maybe you're safe, because he's an incredible general. And she, I think Kristin knows, do you know this guy, Mike Jackson?
Yes.
He's like a sort of incredible, he's quite a liberal general. You'd know him if you saw him. We have a picture of him. And that's quite meaningful for Kristin, and she does this whole ritual to it. And at the end now, she gets Dad, she puts him in with Mum. I don't know, it's brilliant. And I'm sure, I was thinking on the train up here, I've got a couple of other thoughts to give her, just to keep that last 3 minutes fresh. Yeah.
But funnily enough, I have seen that in the lecture thing happen once before, and it was exactly the same sort of rehearsal. It was Marina Carr's Ariel, which was a
version
of the Oristia, but set in County Offaly and Dublin. Mm. And at the end of it, she actually kept Electra alive in the play, and Electra took part in killing Clytemnestra. In fact, I think she did kill her. song. Can you remember the ending? But she definitely nestled up to Mummy. Do you remember?
Did she?
I remember bursting into tears. Yeah.
How interesting.
Maureen told me that had been the young actresses.
Right. And if I'd heard that, I might have said to Christian, don't do it. For example, Orestes at the beginning does this. There's a lot of little rituals and prayers. And I wondered, I thought, well, what Electra is, we know, is a bloodletting. Blood has to be let. So I offered the actor playing Orestes to cut his hand like that when he makes this plea to his land, to his fathers. Frank McGuinness then turned up and said, I love the way you've drawn from Observe the Sons of Ulster. Because did you know that you must have known the first half ends with them all doing this Ulster ritual? I'd never seen that play.
No, I could assume you came out from there.
I didn't know about it. And I was annoyed when he said it because I thought, oh. Anyway, it was good.
I just want to end by asking, we talked a bit about this, for the audience, this experience of coming together to watch a play, Greek Tragedy is a sort of social event, and now having watched it with 900 people there 8 times a week and learning from that experience of the play playing out in front of an audience, having gone through that, is there anything you'd change about the way you approached it originally or in terms of the way it's grown through its actual run?
I wish I'd found a way of doing what they used to do, where they put war consciousness in major focus before the play by doing that ritual with the orphans of the war dead. So my understanding is, before the play began, orphans of people killed in the Peloponnesian Wars or whatever came up on stage and were decorated or honoured in some way, and then the play began. And I tried various approaches to various army widow type things. But, you know, Help for Heroes and all those things, they're great, but they're quite kind of militaristic.
Yeah.
And I couldn't think of a way of doing it.
Well, it's very much in the public conscious at the moment because of all the coverage of
beheadings
and
centenary. Oh, and the Remembrance
so
Day,
to
yeah.
To some extent, it may have been there in the air.
Yeah, I mean, I think I love this configuration of the audience being all around it, that feels to me very live. I can't imagine doing one in a different configuration. But it's, I mean, I really marvel at how alive these old plays are for whole ranges of people, to teenagers to beyond, and everybody is still having profound experiences with them, that they tap into something very primal in us, very primitive in us, yet they're so deft and complex and subtle. I've become a complete nut for the classics from sitting in that room upstairs, from talking to people like you. I'm very, very grateful.
That seems a really good place to end. Yeah. Thank you. It's been an absolute privilege to witness that process from the first exploration of cracking open the archive and to seeing it now in performance, and it is reaching a really wide and broad audience and creating a very primal experience for them, and certainly when I saw it, it was incredibly diverse audience of 900 having a collective, very intense emotional experience, which is an extraordinary vindication, I think, of what we all work on and the classics. So thank you, I think, from all of us for what is a very brilliant, very moving production. Hope you'll join me in thanking Ian enormously, particularly after being in intensive care 3 weeks ago, for being in Oxford today with us and for opening up something of the process behind the production to all of us. Thank you very
much. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the APGRD. If you'd like to hear more, you can visit our website at www.apgrd.ox.ac.uk or look us up on Facebook, facebook.com/APGRD. Thanks for listening.